And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Ever wonder why some things seem so beautiful? A shady place in the woods, a well-crafted phrase, the chorus to a favorite song that fills you with joy each time you hear it. Scientists are beginning to penetrate to the deepest centers of our mind and unlock the secrets of beauty's allure to we humans. We follow that quest and we hear from one of the presidential hopefuls who's talking about the environment. Finally, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, we're here again. First official week of the holiday season 2007. So far, the economists are saying more people are shopping, that's good, but spending less overall. It's odd. It's as if when we hear this, we're supposed to feel a bit shamed so that we go out there and prove we can do our part to keep the whole thing going. Trouble is, we're getting such mixed messages. On the one hand, everyone's going green and clean and conservation is gaining some momentum, and then the good old consumption monster roars at us to get out there and buy, buy, buy. The best news is that most people actually understand all of this, and we're beginning to do the right thing. I'm hoping to make my gifts this year things I make. I went to a thrift store recently and found a recycled book, an amazing book on comfort foods, otherwise known as cookies, cakes, puddings, and other scrumptious things. 'Tis the season to be jolly, and perhaps a bit roly-poly. I just give in. Well, no one's given up this last week in the presidential battle. I've been complaining for years that it's astonishing that with all the realities hitting us these days about our environment, the word is never mentioned in the debates. Well, thanks to good old Grist, which invited all of the candidates to participate in the showcase about global warming and our future, three actually showed up. We will hear what Denis Kucinich had to say during the weekly Earth Summit, coming up in just a moment. In segment two, there's a lot to be said about beauty. As people who love the Earth, the wild beings, the wonder, peace, and the like, beauty draws us onward like a muse. We go in depth, literally inside the human brain, as scientists are beginning to track the series of neurological events that lead to the awe and awesome, or the oh my god, that's beautiful. We talk with Dr. Irving Biederman about beauty and the brain. You'll hear that and the latest nature news, but first, as always, it's time for the weekly Earth Summit. Hello, and welcome to the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and I believe that we can make a difference, and that's why I spend quite a bit of my time trying to be involved in the gift of the American democracy, which was handed to us, and which we are allowing to weather away during our watch. And if democracy is to survive, and based on the arrest of Russian chess champion Anatoly Karpov, who has spoken up boldly around the world on the decline of democracy in his native country, we only need to watch closely what happens to him to understand that our freedoms can be quickly quashed. From my perspective, if you want the world's best environmental candidate, Denis Kucinich is it, plain and simple. He gets it at a deep level, as you'll hear as we play the speech he made at the recent Global Warming and the American Futures event sponsored by those tireless workers at Grist. They invited all of the presidential candidates to participate. Denis Kucinich, Hillary Clinton, and John Edwards showed up, which I feel says a lot about the rest of the candidates. So this week we hear from Mr. Kucinich, and you'll be hearing what Hillary Clinton and John Edwards had to say in the weeks ahead. So now, please welcome Congressman Dennis Kucinich.
It's great to be at a presidential forum that's not sponsored by the coal industry. I just want to say that from the beginning, as the last one was. But I want to speak to you today about a vision of the America that can be. It's a vision that's held close by so many of us, but it's seldom articulated from a presidential forum. And I'd like to begin with paying tribute to those individuals who, in fairly modern times, have shown a commitment to the environment. People like Rachel Carson, Barry Commoner, Thomas Berry, Wendell Berry, Bill McKibben, Al Gore, and others who have taken a stand to show us the path. And now we're called upon as candidates for president to talk about the direction that we would take this country. We see the globe as being threatened. Let me tell you what I will bring to the presidency, an environmental consciousness that is demonstrated by the choices that I make in my own life. A little home in Cleveland, Ohio, 1,600 square feet, a small Ford Focus that gets about, 30-some miles to a gallon, a vegan diet that is compassionate and mindful and respectful of the environment. See, if you want a leader who can reach out and lift this planet up, then we have to look at how do you live? Because you can talk the talk, but do you walk the walk? And so as I speak to you today, I want to demonstrate to you an awareness and an ability to be able to lead this country forward to a new era of environmental sustainability and environmental consciousness. It starts with an understanding of the world as one. I see the world as being an integrated whole. I understand the world as being interconnected and interdependent, and that the choices each one of us makes affects all of us. As any one of us chooses, so chooses the world. And when you come from that understanding, you know the great responsibility that each one of us has individually, and the responsibility we have collectively as Americans to try to engage in what Thomas Berry called the great work of our lives, to repair our relationship with nature and to repair the planet. Now, how would I do that as president? First, I understand the threat that exists right now from nuclear weapons. The United States must lead the way in abolishing all nuclear weapons. We must participate fully in the Biological Weapons Convention, the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Small Arms Treaty, the Landmine Treaty, join the International Criminal Court, and participate in the next round of climate change talks with a real intention of reducing greenhouse gas and carbon emissions. This is what the United States must do, and this is what a Kucinich presidency will be about. But where are we right now? At this very moment, while we gather here in Los Angeles, our government is retrofitting B-2 stealth bombers with 30,000-pound bombs, preparing to drop them on nuclear labs in Iran. This is a war crime in motion, and there's a call of the heart, a cry of the heart, a call to conscience for all Americans to understand the connection between global warming and global warming is oil, the connection between war and ecocide. We have to be here to repair the planet, to know that the real cause of our lives is to heal the world, tikkun olam, the idea of our creative capacity to change everything. It's a call to conscience. And it's also a call for a new vision of what's possible in America. That's what I want to share with you in the next 6 minutes. And that is what I call the Works Green Administration. It's infusing environmental consciousness into every aspect of government and all aspects of our social and economic and political affairs in this country. And here's how it would work. It begins with the intention of having every department of the federal government be involved in sustainability and in green consciousness. Let's go down the list. Transportation. Under a Kucinich administration, massive spending for rebuilding the transportation infrastructure for mass transit so that we can make mass transit available all over America. In housing, in housing, in Senate for building green housing and having the environmental consciousness of our entire building programs be involved in looking at energy-efficient homes, at homes that use natural lighting, in homes that are not using materials that are inherently dangerous. The Department of Energy would provide disincentives for the use of oil, coal, and nuclear, and incentivize the creation of wind and solar microtechnologies so that we could create millions of jobs applying those microtechnologies to homes and businesses across this country, dramatically reducing our carbon footprint, moving the economy, government as an engine of sustainability, priming the pump of the economy, lowering energy costs, insulate millions of homes. I mean, we can do this. We have the ability to do it. We need the leadership to do this. And in the area of health, imagine a president who stands for a not-for-profit health care system with an emphasis on preventive health care, where we meet health challenges like the challenge of obesity, which is directly connected to the kind of diet America has. We need to have a president who understands those connections. In the Department of Education, we would teach our children environmental principles from the earliest age so they can integrate that into the way they live. In the Department of Commerce, all of our trade agreements would be based on environmental quality principles, and we would start by canceling NAFTA and creating environmental principles in all of our trade agreements to protect the water and the air and the land. In the Department of Labor, safe workplace measures that are drawn directly into protecting the health of the workers by making sure that environmental consciousness becomes part of workplace safety. In the Department of Interior, removing all these incentives that exist for the extraction of our natural resources. America must take back ownership of these natural resources and stop the exploitation of the land and protect our Native Americans whose land is being poisoned by uranium mining and other types of mining. We need a president who can take that stand. When I was growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, John F. Kennedy was sworn in as President of the United States. And he excited America with a vision of an America that could be. He urged every American to get an education in the sciences in particular, so that we could participate in this collaborative effort of reaching for the stars. We recognize that our journey is more homebound today, more earthbound. And so, as President of the United States, I would use the intellectual and scientific abilities that exist in the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to move America towards a green economy. There's tremendous amounts of research being done at NASA right now, particularly in the area of carbonless burns, carbonless combustion. And it's amazing what is possible today in America. When you think about NASA being dedicated to creating green technologies where we can call forth a world that we barely understand exists, but knowing the inventive genius that characterizes America throughout our history, we can move towards sustainability using the inventive genius of NASA, where they can create these products in the alpha stage and even license them in the beta stage to help prime the pump of our economy and move quickly to create millions of new jobs. Those who say that we have to sacrifice into the future, I think that's misplaced. I think there's an unlimited amount of wealth out there that's waiting to be called forward by our creative genius if only we will go green. And so, John F. Kennedy called forth the American people to participate in something that was bigger than all of us. And as President of the United States, I intend to do the same thing, to reach out to the American people and ask them to participate in this great effort to save our planet, to protect our environment, to create government as an engine of sustainability, but to look at the choices that each one of us makes. Kennedy said that let the word go forth in its time and place, that the torch has been passed to a new generation. We are the generation that we've been waiting for, and we just need to move forward with courage and with compassion and with vision to create the world that we want. Thank you very much. Thank you. Worst Green administration. Thank you.
Dennis Kucinich delivers, pound for pound, the most message for the moment. He's a good man. Next week, Hillary Clinton. And then, John Edwards. Until then, pay close attention, speak up, speak out, and do the right thing, as our guests do each week, here on the Weekly Earth Summit. We're all familiar with the phrase, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Well, research is proving that it's actually more like beauty is in the brain of the beholder. We'll explore beauty and the brain when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Your attention, please. Thank you for choosing Earth as your planetary vehicle. We hope you enjoy the many wonderful features of this planet as you hurtle through the cosmos. Please note, however, that in the event of continued inaction in the face of global warming, your seat cushion can be used as a flotation device. Also, please take a moment to locate this planet's emergency exits. As you can see, there aren't any. Earth. To America. Can you hear? Sending out a message. Loud and clear. Can you hear?
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Next time you're visiting the Metropolitan Museum of Art, or your favorite neighborhood art museum, you may just want to ask yourself, how is it that people throughout history have been able to create such beauty in painting, sculpture, jewelry, silver, and stone? What is it about we humans that motivates people universally to embellish almost everything with decorations and designs? And then, well, in just a moment, we'll be talking with Dr. Irving Biederman, who has been tracing the perception of beauty into the deepest recesses of the brain. Stay tuned. Beauty and the Brain. We go in depth with Dr. Irving Biederman. But first, the news. Japan says it will not end its whaling in the waters off of Australia, despite the election victory by Australia's Labour Party, which has been a vociferous advocate of taking legal action against Japanese whaling in Australia's Antarctic Whale Sanctuary. Japan's Chief Cabinet Secretary, Nobutaku Matsumura, acknowledged that whales are a problem. "We can't just stop our research all of a sudden," he is quoted as saying. Japan's whaling fleet set out for the Antarctic Ocean a week ago with eyes this year on doing research or harvesting the gracious humpback whales. Matsumura offered, "Humpback whales are very popular in Australia. I have heard that to catch and kill a humpback whale is a very emotional thing. We have discussed this within the government, but for the moment, we are continuing as planned." Reports from those close to the cabinet secretary said his old samurai sword appears to be softening. Meanwhile, Sea Shepherd's annual trek to the Australian Whale Sanctuary was preparing to launch. This is what Captain Paul Watson said in a recent announcement.
A few weeks' time on December 1st with our vessel, the Robert Hunter, heading straight down to Antarctica. We're not going down there to protest whaling. We're going down there to uphold international conservation law against an illegal activity. The Japanese whalers are pirates. They're criminals. They're killing endangered species in the Australian Antarctic Territory in the Southern Ocean's whale sanctuary in violation of a global moratorium on whaling. It doesn't get more illegal than that. Now, we shouldn't be doing this. The government of Australia should be down there doing it. Although they should be sending the Navy down there, because if these were Uruguayans poaching toothfish, they go down there and arrest them. But because of the Japanese, they turn a blind eye and don't want to know about it. It's a discrimination on the application of the law. So we'll be going down there to take an aggressive stand to try and do everything we can to prevent them from killing humpback whales, fin whales, and minke whales.
In what some are calling one of North America's most important acts of nature preservation, the Canadian government set aside 25 million acres of wilderness this week, an area 11 times the size of Yellowstone National Park. The land, located in Canada's vast Northwest Territories, lies in three huge tracts that will be used to create a national park, a national wilderness, and a conservation area administered by native groups. The move is significant, as the areas have been of particular interest by diamond, uranium, and oil and gas developers. Protection of this vast boreal forest is important, as it is the largest land-based store of carbon on the planet, carbon which would be released into the environment if development occurred. Get ready, planet. Global warming is coming. That message is being felt directly in the regions of Bolivia that rely on glaciers for their water. Scientists predict that all glaciers in the tropical Andes will disappear by mid-century. Cities such as La Paz, El Alto, Quito, Ecuador, and Bogota, Colombia, with populations totaling over 11 million people, and which rely on glaciers for much of their water, are facing a very uncertain future. The melting glaciers threaten not only the drinking water supplies, but also agricultural production and supplies of electricity, which rely on steady supplies of water. President Evo Morales has stated that he will seek legal remedies if rich countries do not agree to pay for the damage they've wreaked on the developing world. Morales is quoted, "It's not a question of cooperation. It's an obligation." UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is urging that a new global treaty on climate change provide funding to help poor countries adapt to its damaging effects. No, the Moth Stinger is not a new military rocket. It is, in fact, a jellyfish that makes news regularly by attacking swimmers in the warm waters of the Mediterranean. As the seas warm, so go the jellyfish. In this spectacular move, a massive population of billions of Moth Stingers that spread out for 10 square miles and lay 35 feet deep invaded Northern Ireland's only salmon farm, wiping out 100,000 fish worth 2 million euros as fish farmers tried to shoo the invaders away. Alas, the jellyfish won. The Moth Stinger has rarely been spotted so far north in the British or Irish waters, and scientists cite this as yet another facet of global weirding. When all else fails, ask for divine intervention. That appears to be the last hope of the government of Cyprus, which relies on rainfall for much of its waters. Authorities say Cyprus's largest dam will dry up in the next 30 days. The government is launching emergency deep drilling in an effort to tap into underground water sources. Meanwhile, Cyprus's ancient Orthodox Church called on Monday for prayers to end the drought. Quoting scripture from the Gospel of John, Archbishop Chrysostomos offered his parishioners the following: "We are sure that if we all pray with deep faith, the Almighty will heed our prayers. Ask, and ye shall receive, that your joy may be full." And that's the news. And a few announcements. After 3 years, the Wildside News is continuing to gain momentum. In the weeks ahead, we hope to be announcing some terrific new programs and, well, you'll just have to wait. So now, let's go in depth as we explore beauty and the brain. I'm an artist and a naturalist, a biologist, and one of the things that drives me to the natural world is the extraordinary beauty. And I've interpreted that in many, many different ways, through drawings and paintings, as well music and other forms, and just the literal sheer joy of going out and being in nature. At some point in my life, though, I began to wonder why it was, because I am a biologist and I love to understand how things work and why things work, that we were drawn to such things. And once you start that quest and to try to understand why it is that we're attracted to some things, particularly as it relates to the concept of beauty, which certainly is we talk comfortably about in terms of art or music, there are many other forms of beauty as well, which we'll be talking about today. I'm very interested and fascinated by talking about this subject because it's something that drives me in almost everything that I do. So I want to welcome to the show, to the Wild Side News today, Dr. Irving Biederman, who is with the Department of Psychology, and he's a professor of neurosciences. Dr. Biederman at the University of Southern California. Dr. Biederman, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
The first question that I'd like to ask you is, what is the question that you're trying to address? Something occurred to you and you wanted to get to the bottom of it, which is part of actually the depth of your quest.
The initial observation is that when we look at the world, we're making eye movements in the order of 3 per second. And these eye movements are decidedly non-random. We don't look at blank walls or random masses that we can't interpret. But instead, we look at only parts of the scene or at some scenes rather than others. So there's an enormous amount of selection that goes on. And we were trying to understand how the brain implements that in real time and also what it was that the brain was trying to maximize. What was it trying to do moment by moment during our waking lives and perhaps even in our dreaming lives? And this holds true not just in the visual world, but in the world of conversation, or in fact all perceptual experiences. We're highly selective. We don't attend to everything, but only some aspects of the environment. So while ultimately we'll come up with a neural basis for understanding perceptual beauty, in fact, the real drive is for information, to obtain new but interpretable information about the world. And so what we needed to find out, and we needed to understand, was how could we build in a real-time motivational system that is something that determines what it will be that you'll look at moment by moment during all our waking lives. And this was the quest. This was our goal.
Well, in terms of this process of, we'll call it focusing your attention or where you wish to look or choose to look, what would you say are some of the most critical first considerations in terms of what we're looking for?
What we primarily seem to want to get is, as I said before, new but interpretable information. So what we tend to do is shy away from things we already have seen before. So we don't want to read the same book, go to the same movie, or if we're cornered at a party in some banal conversation, we feel desperate to leave. Or if we go into a doctor's, let's say, examination room, and we neglected to bring a magazine with us, we wind up counting the holes in the acoustical tile. But what we'll see is that the brain has implemented a system to try to maximize perceptual and cognitive pleasure. And when this system isn't satisfied, and it's very easy for it not to be satisfied again in those first moments in the examination room, the experience is not one of pain, but of boredom. So the downside of this system is boredom, and we, of course, typically seek to relieve that by getting new experiences. And the research that we've done has pointed the way to a neural system that implements this. It's a very simple system, but it's one that serves to maximize the rate at which we assimilate new but interpretable information. That is, it makes us infovores.
Yes, I love that term, infovores. Well, that's definitely what I am. I crave information. And by the way, your discussion of going to a waiting room, it's true. You sit down, the first thing you look for is, where is the interesting magazine?
Right.
And then you find that there's no magazines that interest you, and there's a depression.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. No. What am I going to do? That's great. Well, this is an area that fascinates me. And what I'd like to do is just share some of my thoughts on this, and then we'll kind of find where we can go from there. This is my take on this. I've been intrigued by beauty. It started out for me when I was I started to draw plants, literally a scientific illustration of plants. I was teaching myself how to do this. It was a pen and ink, very, meticulous drawings. As I was learning, at a certain point, I'd look at the drawings and I'd say, why don't these work? There was something wrong with them. I was trying to figure out, why. A wild strawberry looked like a wild strawberry. A maple leaf looked like a maple leaf, but it didn't look alive. And so as a scientist and now an emerging artist, I began to ask the question, what's wrong? And what I ultimately came up with was that the difference between my drawings that didn't work and the drawings that would work is the fact that they weren't beautiful enough. This led to a quest. I would take a loop and look at the drawings, the lines, and I came to understand that, for example, in my drawings, the edges of the line weren't perfectly beautiful curves, which they are in nature. Nature, in its forms, are exquisitely rendered. The edges and the curves of a living, healthy, young, vibrant, any living thing is filled with literally beautiful curves. And I found that as soon as I began to render those curves properly, they absolutely came alive. But then that would raise the question from a scientific perspective, but why is it that I can perceive this? Why is it that how is it that we can perceive this concept of beauty? So, interestingly enough, your research and some of my thoughts begin to coalesce. And this is the bottom line. And that is that I ultimately came to the belief that we literally have a sense of beauty. Just as we have a sense of taste or smell or touch, we also have a sense of beauty. That is that when we perceive something beautiful, we feel it. My observation is that when we perceive beauty, there is a human reaction, which is an intaking of breath. That's what we do. It's a literal reaction. The ancients seemed to understand this in the sense that they integrated it into their languaging as they talked about when we say something was so beautiful, it took my breath away.
Right.
The word awesome really perhaps comes from awe, which is how you would spell or say the intaking of breath. What you're doing now is taking what I love to think about and really starting to analyze how that works, how it is that the brain takes this. You're defining what I call the sense of beauty.
I think that's a fair thing to say. The problem, or the potential problem, with saying that we have a sense of beauty, or that beauty is because we, or that we feel it because we have a sense of beauty, is there is a potentiality of circularity. That is, you just say there's a sense of beauty and that that's driven by certain stimuli. And the question is, can we reduce that further? And I think we might be able to. So let me, if I can, and at the risk of some complexity, just describe what is a very simple system in the brain. And we'll just look at the visual beauty, but we can have the same lovely feelings when we hear a nice turn of phrase or read a good novel or have a good conversation and
correct.
So on. So let me stick with vision, because we know the most about that. It turns out about half the human brain is devoted to vision. It's the highest of any animal that we know of. It turns out there's a number of different visual systems. Some are involved with how we reach or motorically interact with objects. But there's a major pathway. It's at the base of the brain, starting in the occipital cortex at the back of the brain, which is often called the visual cortex. And it extends, it runs along the base of the brain to the temporal lobe, where it makes contact, this pathway. It's a series of stages, about four or five stages, where this contact is made of the visual information that's coming in, that's being painted on your retina, to memory so that we're able to interpret what we see. So the retina, of course, that's a photon patch, just little particles of light. And then initially when it gets sent to the cortex, you have cells with very small receptor fields that respond to only a tiny part of the visual field, and they just respond the difference between, I'm oversimplifying, but the difference between light and dark at a given orientation and size. But then as the series of stages proceed further, we reach a stage where we know what it is we're looking at, and it's at this stage that where visual consciousness starts. Until that point, we have no conscious awareness what the stimulus is. So if something's on your retina and you cut off the retina from the rest of the brain, of course you wouldn't understand it.
Sort of like the first point of recognition.
Exactly, where you understand something. And at this region here is where you start doing an interpretation where you know that something's a kitchen or the Grand Canyon or the Eiffel Tower or your friend's face, and so on. Though it doesn't have to be a familiar scene. It could be an abstract sculpture, but you'll know that it's a sculpture that you've never seen before, mm-hmm. some city street that you've never seen before. And, well, it turns out in this series of stages, let's see, it's about five or six stages, there is a gradient, and this was the great discovery and an enormous surprise, there's a gradient of opioid receptors. And where there's receptors, there's very likely opioids. These are these natural brain chemicals that are produced, you know, in the brain that, and essentially when we take opium or cocaine, we're activating these receptors. Well, these receptors are very sparse at the first stages, that is, in the first cortical stage, but they get more and more dense as we proceed forward in the brain to the areas where we make contact with memory. And there's a region called the parahippocampal gyrus that's really loaded with these receptors. So if we could stimulate that region, which is where perceptual information contacts our memory, our knowledge, or lifetimes of diaries, then we get this burst of opioid activity, which is associated with pleasure. So now once we have a given experience, once we see a picture or see a movie or so on, then there's another process that gets set in. It turns out that as you repeat the same pattern, there gets to be less and less neural activity in response to that pattern. And this seems quite counterintuitive because one is learning the pattern better, but there's less neural activity. One might think it would be the opposite. What actually happens is a few of the cells that were initially strongly activated by the pattern, or most strongly activated, they wind up coding that pattern extremely efficiently and wind up inhibiting the billions of other cells that were only weakly or moderately activated by that pattern. So the net effect is that when you repeat an experience, you get less of this opioid activity and it becomes boring. So having that same conversation again or seeing the same scene or when you call up your friend and say, let's go to the movies this weekend and you suggest a movie and she says, I've seen that, you take that as an opinion that you prefer something new because she knows that the second time through, there won't be as much, she doesn't know it this way, that there'll be as much opioid activity, and for $10, she wants to get as much opioid hits as she possibly can.
Practical example of that for me that I've experienced is coming into, let's say, a new town. I love to travel. I think that maybe that's possibly might explain why we love to travel. As I've moved to a new town, the first time I go through, I'm just looking at everything, and I'm thrilled, and everything looks so exciting. One year later, oh, my gosh.
Right.
Why am I here?
Yeah, well, you're on cruise control. You don't even know you're
That's exactly
you're
correct.
Exactly.
Right, exactly
so,
right. Yeah.
So, in fact, this is a very efficient system for the brain to divvy up its neural resources. So it allocates the absolute minimum needed to code an experience. So the neurons that are inhibited by that pattern are now freed up to code up new experiences. And so we never use up all the neural connectivity we have in our brains. So one of the things that happens is that if we can get a lot of interpretation in the scene, like sitting in an outdoor cafe in Paris or looking at some vista, let's say the shoreline, where we see different patterns of the waves or animals going in and out of the water or people and so on, then we're getting this activity, and that would be pleasurable. Now, you can get some opioid activity from earlier stages. So people in general prefer color to black and white. It's more pleasurable. Or if you look at something in stereo, you get more neural activity than if it's a monaural. When you were children, one had these Viewmasters, say. And if you look at the scenes just with one eye or without the stereo effect, you realize you don't get much more information than when you're looking at it in stereo. It turns out the stereo experience will give you more opioid activity, so we find that pleasurable. And I suspect, and this is just a conjecture, mm-hmm. that with your artistic line, that those curves may be doing something of that sort. That is, in the earlier stages, you're conveying information that somehow is giving you more opioid activity, and you're finding that then to be more pleasurable, or you have the sense of beauty.
We love to have thoughts that we understand.
Oh, and it's exquisitely boring not to understand them.
One of the aspects of this is the fact that we have a craving to learn new things, and that in this process, while we're looking through that information, it's not that it isn't pleasurable and it's not painful, but we're just not feeling that moment where something comes together somewhere in our brain where we have that realization.
Indeed, not all the time do we get that great, you know, flood of just feeling a beauty or, oh, wow, that aha.
That's for sure. That's right.
That, oh, now I understand. It feels so great. Like when you study a difficult theorem in mathematics and suddenly it clicks together and that feels so delicious. Not all the time we get that, but on the other hand, let's say we walk into a new room. I'll give first the extreme case. Through one window is a brick wall, and through the other window is this vista of the shoreline and beach and everything. Well, of course we're going to look at the vista. But now you can imagine two windows, and one's just, you know, a little bit more is happening in one than the other. Mm-hmm. Let's say one could be an alleyway with not much there, and the other is a busy street. Well, we'll look out at the busy street.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there might not be a great, you know, feeling of a beauty and awe, as you put it, in the case when we're looking at the street, there's still more information there. And I believe that this system, though it gives us the feeling of beauty and of pleasure, is really designed to get us information. Much of the information that we accumulate in looking out at the world, we may never use. Because we don't live in the here and now, but in a very uncertain future, just acquiring information can be of use. And an example I used is that 30,000 years ago, you're at your cave mouth somewhere in the Serengeti, and you happen to idly look out. You see Zog and Wog are good friends, are being buddy-buddy. A week later, you get into a fight with Zog. And now you know you have to be careful of Wog because he's Zog's buddy. And that little piece of information, which might have been, you know, relatively useless at the time, suddenly becomes significant.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, much of the information that gives us competence in life, we pick up inadvertently. So again, you could have been in your cave and you notice where an axe was. Someone had left an axe. And then later on, you need the axe, you know where to get it. And so what we evolve then is a system of desire, a desire for new but interpretable information, but that's giving us this a competence in handling our world. And it also gives us greater sexual, in the Darwinian sense of sexual selection, it makes us more attractive. All over the world, in every culture that's been studied, intelligence is valued in the potential mate. And the surest sign of intelligence, it's universal, is having lots of information. So when Jay Leno asks, in his jaywalking segment in late night TV, asks, let's say, a very fashionable-looking individual in the Melrose area of Los Angeles, what are the countries that border the U.S.? And this person, this actually happened, thought a while and said, France? And if you ask me, women would think such a guy becomes decidedly unattractive as soon as he says that. And just the other week, another one was, he was asking something about the lowest point in the continental U.S., which, of course, is Death Valley, and he asked, again, one of these people that he stopped on the street, and the person, and Leno asked him, do you know what that would be, the lowest point in the U.S., and the person said, Australia? And not a clue about, you know, or geography is, I guess, one of the domains where people are readily tripped up. But people seem less attractive when they're ignorant.
The interesting thing from my perspective is, how did these systems come about? I'm a fairly strict biologist in the sense that I believe in natural selection, and that when these particular parameters exist in our matrix of behaviors and how we function, even at the neural levels, that these particular things have been selected for. That's the only explanation for it.
Of course.
That there was some sort of survival advantage to having these features, which directly relates to what you just said.
Well, think of it this way. Let's take that room with the brick wall and the vista. Let's say someone walks in and is just as readily would look at the brick wall or the vista. Those genes aren't with us anymore. In other words, if you went through life not acquiring information or not having a drive to maximize the information that you did acquire, you're at a disadvantage. And by the way, this system is present in monkeys. In fact, it was discovered in monkeys. And monkeys will work, will do work pressing a lever. So they a window can open up. They're in a closed cage. So they can have 10 seconds of looking out in the laboratory to see what people are doing. In the same way that we want a window in a room where we could look out at the world. So, again, the monkey's trying to acquire information, and even though the information will rarely be of direct value, you still have this drive, this desire to get information. And the feeling we have of beauty and of pleasure from this is, in fact, what you evolve. You evolve feelings of pleasure that where you get pleasure in the right places, and in this case, getting pleasure from information.
For me, it suggests that people who had this sense, that's why I refer to it as a sense of beauty, by looking or hearing or listening beautiful music,
right,
or a particularly beautiful vista. Most of those forms, whether it's music or art or other forms or even thoughts, the beauty of them comes in the fact that they offer a what I would call a beautiful balance of the dynamics. In a painting, for example, if a painting doesn't have a balance, it's going to be irritating. If a piece of music is disharmonious, we're troubled by it. The minor chords, for example, and that there's a literal cumulative power that happens when we find this balance.
It's interesting that a preference for minor chord, or some dissonance,
yes,
either in music or in art, might be preferred by individuals who are completely, let's say, saturated or adapted to the standard forms. So the preference for, let's say, abstract expressionalism was first experienced by artists who are completely immersed in representational art and were quite competent at it, but wanted something new. And the same could be said about some composers. Though whether there's a different beastie in the head for artists is another matter. But one's guess is that they're showing the same adaptation that we would. So let's say you've read, take a scientist like myself, very familiar with a given area of science. If I read a study that's been done, before, it's no pleasure reading it. For someone who didn't know it, it might be of great interest. And so that may hold true in art, that is, people are always trying to get, again, new but interpretable experiences, and this may be why those who are immersed in the art world often prefer forms that people naive to that form, to that art, might not enjoy, and that they might prefer the more traditional or classical forms.
Well, for example, in art, beauty happens when there's a balance, but symmetry is boring. In other words, that just becomes a graphic design. However, we're attracted to it. A circle, a perfect circle, is probably one of the things we're most attracted to artistically. I've always been fascinated by the fact that humans have an innate sense of beauty, in the sense that going way back to the cavemen that you were talking about. What were the names again? Do you recall?
Zog and Wog.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, Zog is sitting there, and he has a piece of bone that he goes out and he's prepared to hit some mastodon with, and he's sitting around and he's bored, and the next thing you know, he's carving something into it. And when you look at the earliest forms of expression in art, they're not just random ugly forms.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely correct. And this relates to something else that we are interested in, is this artistic motivation. If you look at the cave paintings, let's say in Lascaux, done 17,000 years ago, they were actually, I used to think they were just like graffiti, but they were major projects. They were deep in the caves, maybe a quarter to a half a kilometer in. They were high up because the bottom of the caves was damp. They were painted often, 10 meters, 5, 10 meters up, so they had to build scaffolding.
Mm.
They're all of large animals, and it's unlikely that they brought the animals in rather than eating them fresh, but it was a major production, and yet they were willing to undergo it to do the art. So there's something in the brain of the artist or composer, let's say, that wants to do art, wants to paint or draw or compose music.
From my perspective, I believe it's a means of being able to create our own pleasure.
I mean, there's no question that there is, that there's the pleasure. In fact, we've recently done a study, it's a very simple question that everyone's asked, would you rather be blind or deaf? And everyone's kind of thought about it or opposed it. It turns out that most people say they'd rather be deaf. They wouldn't want to lose vision. But about 25% of the people say they'd rather be blind. And if you ask them why, which is what we did, we had this questionnaire, the main reason is they said they can't imagine living without music. Whereas people who said they'd prefer being deaf, that is, to retain vision, are described in terms of practical reasons of navigation, recognizing the visual world. People who said they'd rather be blind, it wasn't because they would lose conversation. It was music, and specifically making music, playing or producing music. Mm. The people who prefer blind and deaf didn't differ in the amount of music they listened to in an average week. It was just that people did not want to forego, those who said they'd rather be blind, did not want to forego the experience of producing music.
I do music, and I like to create all forms of music. And I will say this, that when it's happening, when you're in the groove or whatever that is, whatever that form is, okay, it feels wonderful.
Right.
It literally feels wonderful.
And there are some people say they can't imagine. A number, again, it was a minority, but to be sure who said they can't imagine living without music. There's also something else about the power of music. The most banal lyrics, like, we don't need no education, done by Pink Floyd. This extraordinary power.
Yes.
And if you were to read those words on a page, it would be a joke.
Yeah. Okay. Any insight into that?
No, we don't. It's one of the things we've mulled over about music, and there's no question that it's releasing these opioids. And in fact, there's been a direct study on that. There's some people who, when they listen to certain musical pieces, they get chills, and some cry. They just feel overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you give them this drug called naloxone, which inhibits these opioid receptors, then they say they hear the music just fine. They just don't have an emotional response anymore to it.
That's very interesting. So the opiates are
involved in music too, it seems.
Mm-hmm. And as well, this concept of emotional content associated with the events.
Correct. The chills or the crying, and the people will describe it as the chills. Mm-hmm. They're just, and I'm sure you felt that too to certain pieces.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Here's an interesting dynamic of this. Music is just puts you to sleep. However, what people seem to want in music is a beautiful form, okay, some sort of form, let's put it that way, that repeats. We love that. It's almost like a rhythm. We like rhythms. We like things that repeat. But if that goes on endlessly, then it becomes boring. And then what happens with the music that gives you that moment where you just have that the release of those opiates is when you've perhaps taken that repeating form and you've stretched it out a bit, and now you're moving off into a different dimension, and then you come back to that theme, that central theme. And I'm telling you, as I talk about it, I can feel it. To me, there's a magic in the resonance. That the central to this is some sort of resonance within the brain, some sort of where there is a coming together energetics that gives us a heightened power. And in this particular case, particularly with the opiates that are released at that point, that really feels good.
Right. For us, seeing that neural or that potential neural substrate at least gives us the potential now to start explaining this extraordinary range of phenomena that I think before was just sweet mystery.
In your research, did you find any sort of quasi-universals that seem to resonate with a vast spectrum of people in terms of what really motivated them to...
Yeah, there were three things about scenes which you can get from an evolutionary perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did is, in one study, people were doing fMRI, and we looked at what scenes that they preferred or didn't prefer. And there were four factors that explain much of the variance about which scenes people preferred versus didn't. One was vista, being able to see a lot versus a close-up. Another one was having that the scene would have some what has been called mystery, that there's something potentially new could happen, something different. Often water or the seashore, the or lakeshore is like that. Just things happen along the shore, mm-hmm. not in the middle of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
A third one is what evolutionary psychologists have called refuge. So there should be a place in this scene where you could see a lot and a lot could happen, but you yourself could be hidden. So you can imagine the value of this if you're on the Serengeti, again, going back to 30,000 years ago. Where do you make your campsite or establish your visit, your village? You want it to be in a place where you could see a lot, so that game or enemies or women or what have you coming by, and you can determine that. And second, you want a place where something could happen. And third, you want to be have the possibility of you seeing a lot, but you yourself not being seen. That is a good hiding place. Mm-hmm. And a fourth dimension was nature. So people prefer nature and, of course, everything that it affords by way of food and water and things like that to artificial environments. Those four factors could account for 62% of the variance of people's ratings of the how much they liked looking at a given scene.
Another thing that I read about, you probably have read the deep literature on this, and that is that historically people talk about the mystics going to the high points. And someone did some research to suggest, and I can understand that this would make sense, that when a person goes to a very high point, the brain actually moves into a different realm. It's working in a grandiose scheme, and therefore the brain starts to function in a different process.
I don't know that one needs to say all that. Mm-hmm. It may be you're just in a position mm-hmm. to acquire more information. And that feels good.
I do know that when I watch people who are trying to find an answer to something, I always find it fascinating how so often there'll be sort of two basic reactions. One is that they'll look up, and they're looking for that universal. And when they can't find that, then their head goes down, and they're looking for the specific to come up with the answer. You know?
Yeah.
So I think there may be some indication that there could be a shifting of the brain processes. In terms of your research, where does this teach you about this process and life, and what can we learn from this?
I think what we have learned, or at least have the beginnings of a theory about what we do with probably 99% of our lives when we're in a non-subsistence existence. That is, when we're not immediately concerned about starving to death or someone trying to harm us physically and so on. The question is, what do we do with the rest of our lives? And the thought is that we're satisfying this other drive or motive, which is to acquire new but interpretable information. And it gives us pleasure, and not to do it gives us boredom. I think we are always doing that. That is, we're always serving this master. The beauty of it is it's never satisfied. So you can never be sated on information. So having assimilated some information, you want to get something new. Been there, done that. So what's interesting about this system is what's called a win-shift system. That is, you get a reward, you won, but now you want to get something else. You don't repeat what's been reinforced, but you want to get something new, and that's the system.
Actually, your research, you work with MRIs, and you're doing extraordinary levels of research. For people who want to go much deeper into this on a much more scientific level, where might they be able to get some information?
Well, probably the most accessible paper is one we recently published. I think it was in the April issue of American Scientist 2006, and it's called Perceptual Pleasure in the Brain. It's by myself and a former graduate student, Edward Vessel. And I think this would give them a nice introduction, a nice perspective on this problem, this domain.
It's elegant research. I'm fascinated by the way in which you really delineate this process of a sort of concentration of information into a sort of a resonant form in the opiate receptor centers of the brain. It's fascinating research.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with Dr. Irving Biederman, who is with the Department of Psychology at the University of Southern California. He's a professor of neurosciences there. Dr. Biederman, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
As I've gone through life on this earth, first as a scientist and then as a naturalist, I became an artist on a scientific quest to unlock the secrets of beauty, which I like to think of as the breath of the divine. You'll be hearing more about beauty in the months and years ahead. I believe that we may just have more than enough technology on the earth. I believe that art based on beauty, is the technology of the future. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth whispers in wonder here on the Wild Side News.